More fundamentally human than a parent or caregiver feeding a child? In that intimate moment of care, the eater receives, but also gives, just as the provider does in their own turn. Around the world, however, and here at home, far too often is this exchange broken and interrupted and interfered with. If ever there were a right to uphold, it's for everyone to eat, to receive, to be cared for. Welcome to Digesting Food Studies, the series that tries to be nourishing about that oh-so-expansive field of learning and knowing and doing called food studies. Today it's me, David Santo, who's holding the spoon. This episode is about the long history and ongoing presence of infant food insecurity. It's a tough subject to address and one that needs attention from all of us, whether we're in classrooms, boardrooms, parliamentary chambers, or nurseries. On today's show, we're talking about things getting better and worse, about the first food systems of infant feeding, as my guest names them, and about the primacy of nourishing our offspring. Though we focus on examples from Canada and the US, this is and has always been an international issue, and one with far too many political implications. At the same time, and as you'll hear, there is reason for optimism, since there is little more potent than a person who is committed to finding food for their kid. The article in focus comes from Volume 5, Issue 1 of Canadian Food Studies, published in February 2018. Alexia Moyer kicks things off with an amuse-bouche that goes back in time to the advertising and propaganda surrounding milk consumption. You will not be surprised to hear that when it comes to marketing related to dairy products, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Then I talk with one of Canada's leading experts on family and newborn food security, Leslie Frank, whose 2018 article on finding infant formula was both revelatory and, unfortunately, a sign of things to come. Her current research continues to examine how caregivers feed their young ones and how challenges in the formal networks of food can sometimes lead to amazing breakthroughs in human collaboration. Then, in the aftertaste, nutritionist and PhD candidate Natalia Alanis Salinas puts together her work with Leslie's to think broadly about food justice and eating rights. Well, hi, Alexia. How are you?
Hi there, David.
I am excited to talk to you about this, partly because the subject of today's podcast is infant and caregiver food security. And so it's a really complicated and important subject. And so even as we get amusing with our bouches here, I also want to remain mindful of how complicated this question is for all the people who are taking care of a newborn. Anyway, tell us what you've got for us today.
So this is why our cultural object today is milk.
Mm.
And I'd like to open the proceedings with a promotional campaign photo taken in 1947. And this was found in Library and Archives Canada. So you can see a copy of it on our website. But for the sake of our listeners, let me describe it to you. In the foreground is a shiny table, possibly formica, but I hesitate to hazard a guess, upon which are placed several glasses of milk. To the left, the recommended daily serving for children at 4+ glasses. To the right, the 3 glasses recommended for adult consumption. So my first question for you, David, is have you had your 3 glasses of milk today?
Absolutely, 100% not. I had about 3 tablespoons in my coffee this morning.
That's about the extent for me, although I am a big yogurt eater.
Well, and that's another interesting development in the milk industry. But anyway, on another subject.
In the center of this display is an apple-cheeked child wearing a Fair Isle sweater over a collared shirt, smiling at someone off camera while he reaches for a glass. Behind him are 2 posters. The one on the left bears the slogan, "Drink milk. It's the thriftiest food you can buy. For economy, health, and all-weather enjoyment, drink milk daily." There's also the requisite mascot, an owl who asks, "Have you who had your milk today?" And it is produced by the Associated Milk Foundation, which predates the Dairy Farmers of Ontario and the Dairy Farmers of Canada. The poster on the right contains Canada's food rules around milk consumption, along with the slogan, "Milk for Everyone." And if you look at the Dairy Farmers of Ontario website, their current slogan is not much different. It's everybody milk.
It's amazing that it has not changed. There's been so much study and reporting and personal accounts, obviously, about how milk is not good for many bodies, how milk is not processed by many bodies, how milk is not generated by many bodies. So it becomes this hot point subject. I remember my mother forcing my sister to drink a glass of milk before she went to school every day, and my sister would vomit in the bushes on her way to school every day because she simply couldn't tolerate it. It's such a complicated substance.
It is. And the photograph itself that we're describing has a lot going on in it, both textually and in image form, about the meanings attached to milk, which we can only begin to unpack in the space of this amuse-bouche. But I think this slogan, milk for everyone, sums it up quite nicely. Milk for everyone in the sense that it is an affordable food item, and two, that it is essential to the health of everyone, and particularly children. Now, these seem, as you said, like two universal, uncomplicated statements, and they're not. And yet, it turns out that milk is not always and has not always been within everyone's reach. And in a quite marvelous collection called Edible Histories, Cultural Politics Towards a Canadian Food History, this is edited by Franca Iacovetta, Valerie J. Koronik, and Marlene Epp.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah. And one essay by Julie Garde gives us a very clear picture of that reality and how people, in this case, the Toronto Housewives Association, responded to this problem of affordability in the 1930s. So I'm going to walk you through some numbers, which I found really interesting. When the Ontario Milk Control Board approved another price increase of 1 cent more per quart to 13 cents, this newly formed group organized a sustained campaign against it.
Wow.
It was a multi-pronged approach, part of which was to point out where the price increase was going. It was not going to farmers, and it was not going to drivers delivering the milk, and not to the cows, but it was going to the dairy companies. But the second approach was to get people to understand what this increase meant to working families. A 1938 study by Toronto's Visiting Homemakers Association revealed that basic weekly food costs for a family of five were about $8. The average weekly income was $17.
Wow.
While the very low paid earned less than $13. Now, given the daily recommended amount, nearly three of those $8 were having to be set aside for milk.
That's a huge proportion, and certainly way more than we think of milk costing these days, let alone formula. Although maybe we can imagine formula costing that much as a proportion of someone's daily or weekly budget. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, this meant that that daily requirement was not being met by a number of Canadian families.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, ultimately, they did not manage to lower prices, but they did slow price increase. And the demands of this association were taken seriously by the provincial government. They had a large membership, and the association became a kind of incubator for women to go into politics.
Well, things are not different today because, as we will discover in our conversation with Leslie, there's this amazing resurgence of grassroots power that's coming up because of the shortages, because of the cost inaccessibility of formula, all sorts of places in the United States and Canada recently, and it continues to be a giant issue. So, you know, the very substance that is considered to be the most important thing to drink every day is also the substance that seems to spur people into political action.
Yeah, and part of the success of this campaign was based on that connection that they made of the naturalness, the natural connection between milk and motherhood and children's health.
Mm-hmm.
And this argument virtually went unchallenged. But as Gard reminds us, and as you have stated, the meanings are often more complex and contradictory than these connections allow.
It's a deep, 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 well, mixture of stuff, as complicated chemically as milk is.
Yeah. And I think that the takeaway from this article is that citizens are encouraged to change their behavior. So the responsibility of milk consumption, of health, remains with the citizens. And there is a shift in focus, or a misdirection, if you will, away from state responsibility, environmental factors, and structural issues that sometimes make these healthy choices an impossibility.
Well, and we know there's a big disconnect between policies and lobby groups' intents and what happens when we get into our own kitchens and our fridges. Well, thanks very much. This has maybe not amused my bush, but it has certainly whetted my appetite to know more. Thanks. Thanks. Leslie Frank is a Canada Research Chair in Food, Health, and Social Justice at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. There, she runs the Fed Family Lab, which focuses on the study of family and childhood food insecurity in order to share evidence for policy change and strengthen the well-being of families. One of her current projects, called Finding Formula, brings together the voices of caregivers and community organizers who dealt with and continue to address the many barriers to procuring infant formula during periods of shortage and scarcity. Well, hello, Leslie, and thank you so much for joining us here on Digesting Food Studies.
Great to be here with you, David.
So we're doing something kind of interesting today. We're diving back into the past, sort of, all the way to 2018 to talk about the issue of finding infant formula. But because that's a project you are continuing to work on today with a brand new version of it, I'd really like to talk about the issue more generally about how caregivers deal with both shortages of formula and all the barriers sometimes that there are to finding it in their place. So let's go back to 2018, first of all, and this article that you published with CFS, Finding Formula, Community-Based Organizational Responses to Infant Formula Needs Due to Household Food Insecurity. It is a big title for a really complicated and complex issue.
Yeah. The Finding Formula short title has been a title that I've unfortunately been able to reuse a few different times on topics that are related to infant food insecurity. Because I study infant food insecurity through a number of trajectories. One, how household food insecurity makes breastfeeding food systems challenging, but also makes it a motivator to breastfeed. So that's just those interesting dynamics about its relationship to breastfeeding as a food system.
Of course, a mother who is breastfeeding her kid has to also be well-nourished herself in order to be able to produce milk, but it's also a less costly option than formula. So very often women can get stuck in a kind of catch-22 there.
Yeah, which is something I've termed the breastfeeding paradox some time ago in another publication. One might think that infants would be the most food secure people or among the most food secure people in any context because of breastfeeding as a sort of non-commercial food system that a lot of people say, oh, well, it's free food. But like any other food system, it has inputs that are necessary, economic inputs, time inputs. And within certain societies, the way they're organized, you mentioned like a mother's economic security, a mother's food security, that all plays into it, that those sort of structural systems need to be in place for that food system to be secure. So I'm interested in first food systems generally and what's necessary to support them. So infants have access to food, and breastfeeding is certainly a component of that. And when that becomes undermined because of economic insecurities, then commercial foods are necessary to feed an infant. And then those come along with a whole host of other problems. And so finding formula is just a term that really expresses how difficult it is for families and mothers in particular, because they do the lion's share of food work in a household, to access a high-priced food, which is sort of those are the new issues that we see emerging, the cost of infant formula, the inflation on it, you know, rising 30% over 2 years. While that problem was the sort of problem I was interrogating in the first article.
Right. So this was already a really big issue, as you say. I like the way you call it a first food system. So the first one that most humans encounter. It's a great way to frame it. So you're saying it's already a big issue many years ago, and then it has become increasingly complicated as costs have risen. But there was also this crisis in production. There was a lack of formula on the shelves.
Right. So there has been a layered of problems around the difficulties of finding formula. So it's difficult to access and difficult to find when you can't afford it, because Canada, unlike some other high-income countries with similar sort of welfare states, doesn't have a state-provided welfare entitlement program for those that are low-income and can't afford infant formulas. We don't have any such program in place. The Canadian way, so to speak, to deal with food insecurity is food charity.
Right.
So that article was about, well, what happens if that's the food item that you need? What would somebody encounter if they had to go find it? This process of foraging for infant formula, looking for it in places they think it might be, but often to encounter that it's in fact not there. And we have like state-run organizations that actually suggest people should look in food banks. So these are publicly funded institutions that say, oh, if you have that problem, you should look in a food bank. And then people go to look in the food bank and it's actually maybe be there or it may not be there. It's not like an infant can eat the other items in a food bank. That's the one food that they need and it's not going to be there.
And even in some of those food banks where it is available, you've told me that sometimes there are other barriers, there are social barriers or there are other restrictions or requirements for the mother to prove her need.
Yes. I mean, there's the same sort of barriers for anybody accessing food at a food bank. You know, they're only opened depending on where you live. Once a week, you may only be able to go once a month. And then, you know, 20 odd percent that are food insecure actually would go to a food bank at all. So families looking for formula, you know, might have some other places they could look. They have a number of inventive strategies for foraging for this food item. It might be asking a family doctor if they have a sample can. It might be asking a family resource center for help. And since I've wrote that article, I do know because during COVID, family resource centers were confronted with this problem even more. And so they did need to find a way, especially with families that were in lockdown, to get infant formula to families that couldn't get out to shop or they didn't have the money to get food delivered. Or some of that did happen, but it's not something that's talked about. It's this problem of food insecurity for the formula-fed infant is a very unrecognized social and food problem in the country. And so there's the economic drivers of why somebody wouldn't be able to feed their baby. Then there's the inflation that's happened since that article. We also know that grocers have spent quite a bit of money putting in surveillance systems to mitigate the theft that's occurring out of need. So we have security guards in some retail spaces around the formula aisle. A lot of infant formulas either in a locked cage, behind glass cabinet.
Yeah, talk about additional barriers. Yeah.
We know it's one of the most stolen food items in Canada.
Which is an indication of something else in the system not working.
Totally. It's absolute desperation. I mean, the other way people try to find formula is online. So going to Facebook Marketplace to make pleas of desperation. There's no official emergency pathway for formula access. There's unofficial things people do, but they could all be ineffective. And right. The outcome of that is that we would have babies either going hungry, skipping feeding times, families needing to water down infant formula to make it stretch for longer, feeding other foods that wouldn't be recommended for the developmental age of children. And it's just a whole host of outcomes related to the inability to access infant formula.
And so the current direction of the project, because the project is continuing and is expanding in different ways, is looking at those, some of those informal networks or somewhat more formalized networks of sharing, exchanging, not just formula, but information about formula, where to find it, when it's available, who's got extra. And that's sort of where you're going right now. Is that correct?
Yes. So the new project, which is also called Finding Formula, because it was just another problem that arose that layered on top of the things I've already said. So in 2022, in the US, there was a crisis level formula shortage just resulting from the closure of one plant.
Wow.
Because of a contamination issue. So that shortage spilled over into Canada. It heavily impacted access to specialty formulas made by that company. But we had already gone through some supply chain issues related to infant formula due to COVID. Mm-hmm. Things were a little unstable. And at the time, Canada didn't produce any infant formula despite our dairy industry. We have nobody making infant formula here.
Wow. That's hard to fathom.
There's one plant online now, Royal Milk. You can buy infant formula milk online. It's not in retail spaces as of yet, I don't believe. So the new project was really about trying to capture caregivers' experience of what happened during that time. While we already knew this was happening in Canada due to economic reasons that people were going online looking for infant formula from peers and non-strangers and through mothers' groups and social media marketplaces, I guess we clocked about 500 new Facebook groups that
wow.
through the United States and in Canada that were created by just mothers primarily, and some fathers, caregivers, grandmothers to help people find formula. They were finding formula Facebook groups. Prior to that, it was a little risky to look for formula online. You know, you're basically exposing publicly that you can't afford to feed your child. You know, there's risks involved with that.
Right, right.
There's also commerce policies of the platforms that make it illegal. You're not allowed to sell a food product that makes a medical claim on Facebook.
Oh, wow.
And in the United States, the states were monitoring Facebook to make sure no one was selling infant formula that might have been provided to them as a state benefit. So it was considered welfare fraud. Well, then when this infant formula shortage hit and people created these groups, it's like everybody's turned a blind eye to that. And the official health authorities in hospitals in the U.S. were actually telling women as they left the hospital that the most reliable place that they could probably find the formula they needed was through a Facebook group.
Wow. So a lot like the way food banks have become sort of institutionalized by the authorities, now Facebook has become institutionalized as an exchange space.
And not just Facebook as the platform, but think about it. It's the mothers that created the group that are monitoring the groups really became, you know, filled the public policy gaps.
So in one way, this is a wonderful story. And in one way, this is a tragically awful story about systems collapse,
exactly.
But also about the resilience of humans to do stuff that they need yes. to get food and get food for their families.
That's been the storyline that we've been talking about a lot. And we interviewed 15 people that created these Facebook groups in Canada and the US. And I interviewed a lot of people over my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never so gobsmacked than the stories that they told about what they went through, the work involved of creating the group, monitoring the group, keeping the scammers out of the group, driving formula, delivering it to people, having people show up at their houses, you know, like in desperation, and just all they can do is give them a hug because they don't have anything. Writing inspirational messages on the tops of cans. Like they were actually just running a Facebook group. They were creating distribution systems across the city and then connected to other cities, like transportation systems to move product. One person talked about making a computer program to locate when supplies were coming in. They had insiders working in retail spaces that would leak information to them because they weren't allowed to tell anybody. You know, there was all these retail rules, but the work that these women did, and they did it just because they were somebody that needed to feed their baby
right, right.
themselves. So what you see is this like incredible ethic of care,
mm-hmm.
incredible amount of labor.
Yeah.
But as one woman said in an interview, I'm not a government resource. I work at a plant overnight. I work shifts and I do this in the daytime. She's like, I don't have a budget. She's like putting gas in her gas tank with her own money to like deliver. And they say in all the public policy that was put in place, bring supplies in the States in Operation Fly Formula. She's like, we never saw it. Any of it.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, I guess it's like a real demonstration of mutual aid, but it's also equally a demonstration of public policy failure. There was groups in Canada as well doing the same type of work. I mean, and that's where the project started, talking to these women to say, you know, tell us what happened and what it was like from your experience of engaging with people on a daily basis with this problem.
Wow. Well, this is clearly an ongoing and fascinating and complicated and messy even subject. I'm really excited that you are doing this work still. I think it's going to be offering a great deal to the food studies community to understand this situation better. As you say, it's not well understood and it's not well researched. So hooray. And I'm sorry that the situation exists, but I'm really excited to see the next article, maybe in CFS, maybe elsewhere, and seeing how Finding Formula proceeds. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, David.
Natalia Alanis Salinas is a PhD candidate at the University of Saskatchewan, working in community and population health sciences and addressing school food programs, among other subjects. She previously worked as a nutritionist in Chile, where she taught and worked in municipal strategy and community health.
Hello, I'm Natalia Alanis Salinas, and I'm a PhD candidate in community and population health sciences at the University of Saskatchewan. I am originally from Chile, where I worked as a public health nutritionist before moving to Canada. So my research over the past few years has focused on school food in Canada, specifically what children eat during school hours and how school food programs can support better nutrition. I have also been exploring how these programs relate to other outcomes, like attendance and academic performance. Another area I am interested in is how school food programs operate in different communities and contexts. Our team works directly with people running and participating in these programs, school staff, families, and students, to better understand what's working, what's not, and what can be improved. And while most of my work is within the Canadian context, I have also been involved in projects based on international experiences, which have helped me see what we can learn from approaches in other countries. So I found this article really powerful. It highlights how feeding infants is still often treated as a family problem only, something that caregivers, mainly mothers, are expected to manage on their own. One of the key points it raises is the lack of clear, consistent public policy on infant food insecurity. Not all infants are breastfed, and that's too many reasons. Infant formula is expensive, and currently, there is not a structured way to ensure that families who need it can actually access it. That connects strongly with my own work. We often say we want children to eat healthy at school, but healthy food is not cheap and it's not always possible for caregivers to provide it every day, especially when they're managing many other responsibilities. So instead of recognizing this as something that should be addressed through national policy, we have left it up to schools and local programs to handle it, often without adequate support. Their article shows a very similar situation when it comes to infant feeding. We place the expectations on families and communities, but we don't provide the structural support they need. The result is that access to support depends on where people live, which organizations are available to them, and how these organizations choose to operate. That makes the level of support uneven. But the larger issue is that we are missing a coordinated public policy approach to food insecurity, one that takes responsibility at the governmental level. This article definitely helped me to think about the topic from a new perspective. It helped me to connect the dots between infant and child food insecurity more clearly. Both are shaped by systematic barriers, and both depend heavily on unpaid care work, mostly from women, without the proper resources in place. There is a saying I really relate to. You don't teach someone how to swim while they're drowning. That fits this situation very well. We cannot respond to infant food insecurity by simply encouraging a return to breastfeeding. That might be a part of a longer-term strategy, but in the short term, there are children who are already on formula and hungry, and we need to support them now. It is essential to provide families, especially mothers, with the resources they need. And above all, make sure that infants get what they need to grow and thrive. Infants have the right to food and to be fed. Their well-being should not depend on whether they fit into a certain feeding approach. And yet, it often does, because we don't have the policies in place to ensure they are supported. I would recommend this article to anyone working on food policy, gender, or social issues. Even though it focuses on infant formula, it opens up bigger questions about how food insecurity is handled and how little attention it receives at the policy level. It is also a strong example of how qualitative research can document lived experiences and give voice to what's happening in communities. For those working on school food or other community food programs, this article shows what can happen when responsibility is shifted to local actors without giving them the tools or resources they need. It's a reminder that addressing food insecurity requires more than good intentions. It requires real coordinated action.
I have been unbelievably privileged all my life when it comes to food. Well fed by my parents, well educated in nutrition and cooking and gastronomy, and well nurtured when it came to my own curiosity and cultural expression. I'm so incredibly grateful for this. And as hard as it is to think about the vast populations who are not as surrounded by food and love and bounty, so I must, as must we all. Those of us with full stomachs need to yell loudly at our politicians to make change now. To enact policies and fund programs, to make food accessible and affordable, and to never, ever use food as a weapon or as a tool of coercion. There are many ways to do it and many things that have to happen at once. None of us can do it alone. Thanks so very much to today's very nurturing guests, Alexia Moyer, Leslie Frank, and Natalia Alanis-Salinas. Our executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Check the show notes for a link to that remarkable milk advertisement that Alexia talked about, as well as the book Edible Histories, Cultural Politics. You'll also find a link to Leslie's Fed Family Lab website. Please also think about submitting an article or a perspective or commentary to Canadian Food Studies, or get in touch and tell us how you're taking action to make infant food insecurity a thing of the past. Inspiration is infectious. Milk's ubiquity in many food cultures is perhaps unsurprising, given that so many mammals produce it and so many things can be done with it once it has come out of those creatures. Yet it's also a substance that is not consumed by billions of people, once they're making their own food decisions on their own, that is. Milk's not neutral, and its commercial variants are not even the same substances that they were 200 years ago. Did you know that there are hundreds of chemical and biological components in milk? There are also just as many stories about it to lap up.